Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the federal land banks when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. And you shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. But you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, you know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed that scriptural law that we see in Deuteronomy 25:13 through 16 when they put into our federal constitution these 17 words that say, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." You'll see that at Article 1, Section 10 in our federal constitution. But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away. And in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of these just weights and balances from the scripture, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Well, now, in the intervening 70 or 80 years, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School, which is conducted twice a year here at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. It's free of charge. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, and then go to our archives page, and you can download. All right, we're talking about the Federal Land Bank. It's a story written by Raymond D. North, who is a certified public accountant. He's a tax preparer. And he came upon the secret, kind of by accident. And then, as a result of that, he wrote the book called Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains, and it's put out and published by Acres USA. So if you want a copy of the book you're looking for, Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains, that's the title. Raymond North is the author. And you want to call Acres USA to get a copy. The number at Acres is 1-800-355-5313. Again, that's 1-800-355-5313. If you didn't have a pen handy, hang on. I'll give you that name and address at the break. Now, what's going on here is genius. It may be wicked and evil genius, but by God, it's genius. And I think it came right from Satan the devil. I'm not sure that human beings could have carried out a plan this diabolical, this wicked, this evil, and carried it out with such ease and dispatch. It started in 1916. Actually, it got started in 1884 with the inception of the plan. It was executed in its first phase in 1916. It's been in operation now for nearly 100 years. And we've had farm programs that come out of our Congress almost every year. And this CPA who does tax returns for farmers on the Great Plains, he compared the farm bill, which was engineered and designed to help these small farmers. And then when he worked out their taxes and worked out their contracts, he said, "Well, my God, this farmer owes more tax than he has income because he participated in this farm program. If he hadn't participated in this farm program, he wouldn't be in this financial pickle. Now he's going bankrupt because of this farm plan, which was designed to help him." And so he looked at farm plan after farm plan after farm plan, and he looked at tax return after tax return after tax return, and for 80 years, every single one of them worked against the farmer, and it worked for multinational corporations, land banks, the Federal Reserve, the government. It worked for everybody but the farmer, but it was designed to help the farmer against everybody else. Now, you know, boys and girls, the law of averages would say that if it was just put out by ignorance and stupidity, once in a while, one of these farm bills, one of these farm programs would actually benefit the farmer. He said, "No, not a single one." Now, there are times when the farmers made great profits, like in the 1950s. That was a part of the genius. What you do is you engineer the farm program to induce the farmer to join into contracts to divorce himself from his constitutional rights. Then once you've got him engaged in the contracts, and you engage him in the contracts by giving him profits. So he signs up, takes the profits, engages in the contracts, then Congress changes the law and buries him. It's like a military campaign, you know. You're out here fighting a battle, and then you develop a strategy to make your opponent think that he's beating you, and then you retreat, and you retreat, and your opponent chases after you, and then pretty soon you stop running, then you close the trap on your opponent. And your opponent now, sucked away from his line, sucked away from his lines of supply and from support, gets cut off by another army that he didn't know anything about, and then he's annihilated. Now, in the battlefield, we say that's genius. Well, this is a war, and this is a war that's being contested for control of the world. It fits right into Bible prophecy, although this author isn't concerned with the Great Tribulation or Bible prophecy. He's just sitting here concerned about the farmers and the farm programs and parity and one thing and another. And the thing that caught my attention was Reaganomics. I thought Reaganomics was there to revive the economy. Oh, no, no. It's a part of this international world program to bankrupt America. President Reagan was in on the scam. Now, he appears to be the conservative. No, no. Ronald Reagan was never a conservative. He was an arch-liberal. George Bush appeared to be a conservative. No, no. George Bush is not a conservative. He's a member of Skull and Bones. Skull and Bones is one of the secret societies organized for the purpose of creating the one world government, the New World Order. But then you didn't have a choice between George Bush and Al Gore. Al Gore is a part and parcel with them also. We haven't had a presidential choice since 1933. Roosevelt was our man, and every presidential candidate from that point on has been our man. Do you remember Harold Wallace Rosenthal? Now, sometimes people will write me and they'll say, well, this is just a diatribe against the Jews. No, you Jewish people, sit back, relax. This isn't a diatribe against you. You're just as much a part of this deceptive program as is the average Catholic who doesn't understand the Jesuit order or the Knights of Columbus. And our Creator told us now that we would be deceived. This is in Revelation 12:9. This is a part of a great deception. Jesus told us about this great deception in Matthew 24. Moses told us about it in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. It's not something new. It's been around for a long time. It's just that what we're seeing today is the culmination of the program. And being able to understand the program and how it's being implemented will make the difference between whether or not we will be in that 10% of survivors or the 90% of the victims. I kind of like it to my students here like riding on the Titanic. When the Titanic sinks, which it's going to sink now in the next 2 days, 48 hours, I ask my students, do you think you could save yourself off of the Titanic after having read the book and seen the movie? Do you think that you could have done something different knowing what you know now had you been in that position? And everybody says, well, of course I could. Of course I could. And what we need to do to change history is to be in front of Lifeboat 6. See, you girls out there and you children, you don't have a problem. Women and children first. It's all of us men. So the victims on the Titanic, while there were some women and children, primarily the space on the lifeboats went to the women and children. It's the men that had a problem. And there was only two lifeboats that left the Titanic that weren't full. Lifeboat 6 and the one that had Bruce Ismay and the other six on it. One lifeboat left only had 6 or 8 people in it, and one of them left only had 30 on it. And as a result of that, a lot of people that could have been in those two lifeboats died because they weren't. So now I've read the book and seen the movie. Well, same thing is true now with the great ship America. We don't need to be concerned about saving America. The great ship America has already hit the iceberg and we're already sinking. Our president says, look for green shoots, everything's going to be fine. I'm looking for Lifeboat 6. That's where I'm standing right here. And I didn't do this accidentally, but I didn't know exactly why, so now I want to tell you why. And this is the guy that's going to tell us. Remember, the guy's name is Raymond D. North, and the book is called Night Came to the Plains. No, Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains. Now, remember in the last program we were talking about who owns this federal land bank? Is it federal or is it private? The answer is it's private. It appears to be federal, just like the Federal Reserve. Is the Federal Reserve government? That is it public or private? The answer is totally private. Yeah, it's true. The President of the United States appoints the chairman of the board and the board members, and the Congress approves them and so on. Congress could abolish the Federal Reserve. Congress could abolish the federal land banks. They don't, they haven't, and they won't, because the Congress is bought and paid for by the secret societies. Now, one of the guys that helped me understand this problem a little bit was a fellow by the name of Milton Kagan. Now, he was a Jew. He was our company controller at the Atlantis Company. An old man in his mid-70s came into the company at my request to help me save it. And he did. That's the guy that taught me how to count, Milton Kagan. And I asked him this question. I said, does the average Jew know and understand the protocols of the learned elders? And he said, not at all. And he said, the average Jew goes to synagogue and he's Joe Sixpack and he's a nice guy. So for the rest of us out here, let's not throw rocks now at the average Joe Sixpack Jew. That's not our problem. The problem with Catholicism isn't with the average Joe six-pack Catholic flipping through his beads on Sunday morning. The problem with Catholicism starts with the Pope and through the administration down. Those are the guys that know what's going on. Those are the perverts. Those are the officers. Now, in the Bible, they're called Pharisees. And these Pharisees, you know, are still in operation today. I showed you that in past programs. And this guy here, while he's not bringing to light the Pharisees, he's not bringing to light the international bankers, these international Pharisees, he's certainly bringing to light what they have done, what they have accomplished, past tense. So I mentioned that to you in the last program. We're not concerned with voting in the next election to save America. This is a done deal. It's dead. It's already been captured. They're already in control. There isn't anything you're going to do. There isn't anything I'm going to do. Save for saving your own life. So on page 78, he says, actually, from day one, the federal land banks have used the argument that they are private when they want a benefit provided by state law, but that they are a federal instrumentality when they want a benefit provided only by federal law. Boys and girls, that is genius. That isn't set up by a bunch of schlocks that didn't know what they were doing and couldn't get the story straight. That's a genius setup between the two so that we can benefit from both laws at the same time. It's kind of like long and short. When the banker, when the economy is moving up, they're buying short. And then when it hits the top and starts down, they collect on the shorts. The banker makes money when the stock market's going up. He makes money when the stock market goes down. Doesn't make any difference to him. These guys, they don't make any difference to them if it's going up or down. They make money in both directions. This is a private institution just like the Federal Reserve. These banks are poorly capitalized. And over the years, earnings were used to support the system. Then any leftover was returned to the farmer borrower as a patronage dividend, and little or none was kept by the banks. Now, it's noteworthy that for decades, farmers received tax forms from the bank at the end of every year showing patronage dividends. The farmer then reported this on his income tax on Schedule F on his return. He paid income taxes on it. Now, if he earned enough income to be legally required to pay, and in addition, he paid Social Security taxes on it, since the banks distributed most of their earnings to their customers, they have very few financial reserves. And when the crunch came, the reserves of the banks proved to be inadequate. This is different from how commercial banks operate. If a commercial bank makes money, it will invariably hold on to some of the earnings and place them in the capital structure of the bank. This strengthens the financial condition of the bank. This money that commercial banks earn cannot be rebated to their customers. Federal and state law prohibit commercial banks from doing this. And also, a commercial bank must increase its capital accounts as the bank grows and does more business. The commercial banks may, and they often do, pay dividends to their stockholders. However, before doing so, they must notify state or federal regulatory agencies, depending on which government chartered them, and then get permission for payment of the dividend. But these laws do not apply to the federal land banks because they're private businesses. Note how the reasoning switched. They are now private. Now, another weakness inherent in the capital structures of these banks is the fact that they exist on borrowed money. When a farmer wants a loan, the bank uses only borrowed money to fill his need. Each of these 12 federal land banks is expected to raise its operating money outside of the federal budget. And they do this by selling bonds in the private financial markets, which is another way of saying that they sell them through Wall Street. Wall Street? Oh, the bankers on Wall Street. These are all Jewish bankers on Wall Street. Well, for the most part, they are. Now, the bonds are then resold to anyone or to businesses across the nation that wants to invest in them. Now, who owns these bonds? It is estimated that 1,200 banks across the nation had officers who were stupid enough to buy these junk bonds. Also, some state and local governments have a lot of them in the retirement pension plans of their employees. I like the way this author uses them, and I'm going to underline this. Stupid enough. You show me one stupid Jewish banker partner. Name him. There are no such things as stupid Jewish bankers. That's an oxymoron. Now, in Congress, if Congress lets these banks collapse, which would be the best thing to do, then Congress would be bailing out the commercial banks the way it is now bailing out the savings and loan industry. Hey, boys and girls, let's go back in time a little bit. Do you remember a guy named Andrew Jackson? And Andrew Jackson vetoed the U.S. National Bank Bill. And they said, you're going to bankrupt thousands of people. And President Jackson said, that may be true. But if I don't, I will bankrupt hundreds of thousands of average citizens. And I'm not going to do that. I've mentioned this to you a time or two. We just bailed out the banks here in the last couple of years to the tune of $29.1 trillion. I know they tell you it's $15 trillion, $9 trillion, $6 trillion, you know. No. The final number on it was 29.1. It's not all in cash. Much of it is in guarantees. You know, we promised to pay. Let's take a look at one of those. You know, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which was totally self-sufficient and funded by the bank, well, as of last week, they are underfunded by $40 billion. I think it's 40. I mean, they're negative 40 now. But they have a $500 billion guarantee. That's a half a trillion. See, it's a half a trillion guarantee. They haven't touched it yet, but anytime they want to, and they will as time progresses along, they're going to tap into that. That's part of that $29.1 trillion, the bailout. See, President Jackson said this. He said, when you bankers make money, you keep the profits. When you lose money, you pass it on to the taxpayer. And that's just exactly what we saw happen here. That's what we saw happen with the savings and loan deal back in 1990. That's exactly what happened to these federal land banks in 1984 when they ran out of money. So I just wanted to let you know that the system that is in place has been working perfectly since 1884. They've used it over and over and over again. And they're using it right now in front of your eyeballs. In fact, I can't think of any reason why they'd want to change. They have a 100% record of success. Why they'd be foolish to change. There isn't any purpose on it. But because they've used this process over and over again, it sets up a pattern. And so this author goes back and says, oh my God, look at the numbers. Every single time a farmer signs up, he buries himself in debt under the terms of the contract, which drives him to bankruptcy. And so from 1920, when we had about 40 million farmers on the land, until today when we have less than two. And you see, if you drove all these farmers off the land in a year or two, you know we'd be up in arms. They've done it like the camel sticking his nose in the tent. Just little by little, year after year, for 80 or 90 years, and then one day you wake up and you're out in the sandstorm and the camel is in the tent, and that's exactly where we're at today. All of us are out here in the sandstorm and the bankers are in the tent. Now, that didn't happen just by happenstance. That didn't happen because of some bad breaks or some, you know, some bad years or droughts or something like that, although I'm sure that the droughts of the 1930s helped exacerbate the problem. But this is a well-thought-out plan. It's an agenda, and it has worked perfectly. It has never failed, and this guy has uncovered it. And this is the book. This is why I'm suggesting that you get it. Now, remember, I can't read you the whole book. I'm just going to zero out this one chapter. And as we progress along, I'm going to show you exactly how this has already worked, past tense, and how it was predicted to work from 1884 until 2010. And from 1884 to 2010, this sixth protocol has worked perfectly. So even if you say it isn't Jewish, it's irrelevant. Call it communistic. Then the communists are the geniuses, and the Jews aren't. Or it's the Republicans that did it, and then the Republicans are geniuses. Or it's the Democrats that thought it up, and they execute it, and it's the Democrats that are these geniuses. You know, take your pick. It could be the Catholics, the Protestants, the Jews, the Muslims, the Communists, the Germans. I don't care who you pick. Just pick a number. But as a reporter, I want to show you that it has worked so well that the average Joe Sixpack doesn't even know it. That's the genius behind it. We have taken you into national captivity, and you think you're free. You haven't even recognized your own captivity. I call that genius. Now, he says, so support the federal land banks, this reasoning goes. Actually, there is another side to the argument. It is a grave sign of moral aimlessness for someone to argue that we have to do this because it will in time cause a bigger economic mess. Hey, wait a minute. Let me pause here. Isn't that what they just told us, that if we don't bail the banks out, we'll have a bigger economic mess? Last week, didn't I point this out? My God, if I didn't have my flu shot, can you imagine how sick I'd be today if I hadn't had my flu shot? It's the same kind of circular reasoning of an insane person believing that over time, if we keep doing this, we'll get a different result. What can be wrong with trying to do the right thing economically for just once? In the name of Aunt Sadie's sacred garter belt, what's wrong with trying to do the right thing? Now, many people have the mistaken idea that these bonds are guaranteed by the U.S. Treasury. In general, they are not. But a few bonds have been guaranteed in some way by the government. The interest on some of the bonds issued during the 1930s was guaranteed by the government. That is, the bonds were not guaranteed, but the interest was. Some of the bonds issued in 1984 and thereafter have certain guarantees by the government. Hey, isn't that Freddie Mac? Huh? Isn't that this Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac thing all over again, too big to fail? And they're called GSAs, government-sponsored agencies. The exact same thing here with this federal land bank. When they go upside down, they have an option. You know, we can have the government pick up the tab and put it on your back, Mr. Taxpayer. Or, as this author says, hey, let these guys go bankrupt and let these bankers on Wall Street take the hit. That's what we ought to have done, but we didn't. That's what Andrew Jackson did. He said, you bankers take the hit. Too bad for you. Hey, now they're back in the saddle. And as Josiah Stamp once observed, he said, hey, you can take all the money away from the bankers, but leave them the power to create money, and with the flick of a pen, they'll have it all back again in 100 years. Now, that's why you have to have land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Now, you farmers are loath to practice that Ten Commandment model, land Sabbaths and Jubilees. And then the rest of us, we're loath to practice land Sabbaths and Jubilees, which would be the out for all of this horrendous debt. So the bankers now have buried us under this mountain of debt, and they're going to hold us in credit debt serfdom until Jesus comes back and frees you. But the ace up your sleeve is you can free yourself before the second coming if you'll go back to practicing that Ten Commandment model. I'll show you how that works as we progress. Now, in general, the bonds are not guaranteed. Some believe that the income from these bonds are not taxable on one's income tax returns. The bond interest is exempt from state and local taxation, and this is one of the features that makes them attractive to some investors. Some taxpayers have purchased these bonds solely because they do not have to pay state income taxes or federal and state inheritance taxes on them, but in general, all income from the bonds is taxable to the federal government, since the banks are instrumentalities of the federal government. Hey, you catching on to this? Like the Federal Reserve, it looks like, it acts like, everybody believes it's federal, when in reality it's private. So the feds come in and tax it, but the states don't because it's private. Hey, isn't that special? Again, boys and girls, I tell you, that's genius. I don't know who thought that up, but it's way beyond anything that I can do. That's way beyond my pay scale. I'll tell you that right now. Now, note how the legal existence of these banks has shifted back to federal existence. At no time has Congress ever let these bondholders suffer due to their bad investment. Nothing would make the banks responsible faster than for Congress to let these bondholders hold an empty bag, but they never have, and they're not going to. So, just like Andrew Jackson said, when the profits are there, the bankers take them. When the losses are there, then the Congress comes in and puts it on our back so that we can pay for the losses. By golly, you can't beat a deal like that. That's heads we win and tails you lose. Now, whoever it was that thought this up, whether it be the learned elders in 1884 in Zurich, Switzerland, or somebody else at some later time, you got to give it credit where credit's due, don't you? Hey, listen, it's halfway time, and I got to give you a reminder here to satisfy all of the legal beagles around the world here and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, Night Came to the Farms of the Great Plains. It's written by Raymond North, and it is published by Acres USA. The telephone number there is 1-800-355-5313. I would call them first, toll free, 1-800-355-5313. Get the price of the book. I don't know what the price is. We we get these books in here. I don't know. It's copyrighted 1991, Raymond D. North. Published in cooperation with the National Organization for Raw Materials, Acres USA, Box 9547, Kansas City, Missouri 64133. Now, Acres has moved. Now, they're in, they did move to Metairie, Louisiana, and then to Austin, Texas. They're located at Post Office Box 91299, Austin, Texas, 78709. So that's Acres USA, Post Office Box 91299 in Austin, Texas. That's the last address that I've got from the July 2010 Acres USA newsletter. All right, going on, listen to this. These banks, talking about these federal land banks, take the borrowed money that they get from selling these bonds and loan it to the farmers. This borrowed money is the Achilles heel of the farm credit system as represented by these banks. These banks do not have capital accounts or deposits as do commercial banks. Commercial banks get most of their lendable money from deposits made by their customers. These land banks also differ greatly from insurance companies. For example, let's say an insurance company sells a life insurance policy on a day-old baby. Well, in theory, that baby will live to be 75 years old or more. Of course, the baby could die young, but statistically speaking, that's not likely to happen. Insurance premium rates are geared to cover such unhappy eventualities, and they will pay for all of those dead babies. The premiums paid on the policy, though, can be used by the insurance company for many years. The first premium can be used for 72 years, and the second premium for 71 years, and the third premium for 73, or 70, and so on. The insurance company accumulates the premiums from many policyholders. It then has the cash in the bank when a farmer applies for a loan. It does not go out and borrow it. That's the big difference between how an insurance company or a commercial bank operates as compared to these federal land banks. Now, the insurance company has money to loan. It will not need that money for many years. Now, when the farm economy collapsed in 1981, the federal land banks were operating almost totally on borrowed money. Wall Street and its many investors wanted the interest on the bonds and the principal as the bonds matured. And under the law, they certainly were entitled to that. But the federal land banks could not get it from the farmers who could not pay. So they resorted to strong-arm tactics against the wheat farmers, another principal cause of the devastation that hit the farms of the Great Plains. In the federal land banks, or if the federal land banks had reserve funds, they could have carried the farmers through the economic collapse as the insurance companies did and had done before. Now, in 1916, when Congress set up this land bank system, it provided that on each loan made by the bank was to sell stock equal to 5% of the loan, and this money was to increase the capital reserves of the bank. Now, if this had been done properly, the banks would have had plenty of reserves today in the Farm Credit Act of 1971. But in that Farm Credit Act of 1971, Congress repeated that the farmer must invest in stock in that farm credit system. That's in section 1.16 of the Act, which reads as follows, quote, stock shall be paid for in cash at the time the loan is closed, unquote. So Congress then mandated that this stock investment be paid for in cash in order to build up the bank's cash reserves. But this was not done. And I'm unable to find just when the intent of Congress was bent, prostituted, made ineffective. But most of the earlier loan closing documents have long since disappeared. And I believe that it was sometime in the early 1970s when they disappeared. But in any event, the federal land banks developed and they concocted a method of avoiding, of getting around, or of eschewing what Congress had twice directed. Here's how the scam works. Let's say that a wheat farmer wants a loan of $90,000. And this $90,000 is the amount that is applied for. Well, then he should pay $4,500 in cash to buy stock to build up the reserves of the bank. This loan application was made to the local federal land bank association. It is not made to the central bank, say, at Wichita, Kansas. The federal land bank of Wichita, Kansas would then boost this loan up to $100,000. Then that bank would draft a check to the farmer for $5,000, which was the 5% surcharge to build up the capital reserves of the bank. This is on the $100,000 boosted loan, not the $90,000 that the farmer applied for, the $90,000 the farmer wanted. So in theory, this check then went to the farmer. At least it was made out to the farmer. But in actual practice, the check was mailed to the loan office located in the local federal land bank association, not to the farmer. Now notice that we have 12 of these federal land banks. But out in the local areas, you have what's known as the Federal Land Bank Association. So you have two organizations here. One is the association and the other is the land bank. They're private, and they get their money by borrowed money from selling bonds. Now the farmer comes in and he's going to sign a contract with the Federal Land Bank Association. Watch how this goes. Now the farmer would come by the office and he would endorse the check to the Federal Land Bank Association, which would then give him a $5,000 stock certificate of the local Federal Land Bank Association. He doesn't get a stock certificate in the Federal Land Bank. He gets it in the association. But the check came from the Federal Land Bank in Wichita. Now the Federal Land Bank Association then deposited the endorsed check in its account and then wrote out a check to the Federal Land Bank of Wichita for $5,000, which put it back into its checking account. Now the Federal Land Bank of Wichita would then issue $5,000 worth of its stock in the name of the local Federal Land Bank Association, not to the farmer. So the Federal Land Bank of Wichita got the money from the association, not from the farmer. Does this build up the capital reserves of the Federal Land Bank as Congress has twice directed? Well, the answer is no, it does not. Let's look at the hypothetical checking account of the Federal Land Bank for a week and see. On the date of the check for $5,000 it was made out, the bank received a loan payment from the farmer Cooper in Kansas for $20,000 and another check from a Wall Street bonding firm for $1 million for sale of bonds, and it received a check for $14,000 from Farmer Dykes of Oklahoma and a check from the same amount from Farmer Jones in New Mexico. Then it wrote a check to Farmer Smith to close a loan of $120,000 that it received, and then it receives a check for $5,000 from the Federal Land Bank Association down in Oklahoma on the original farm loan. Okay, now all of these transactions flowed through the checking account of the Federal Land Bank in Wichita, Kansas. Now, it's very easy to miss the point that no increase was made in the bank reserves. Now, as far as I know, no other writer on this subject has ever mentioned this. It is important to understand this central fact in order to comprehend why the banks have depleted the reserves and how they collapse so easily. All right, it's done by arithmetic. And it's done in opposition to the mandate of Congress because the federal land banks are private. They're not federal. You got that? They're not breaking any laws. The Congress comes out and passes this and says, here's what we want you to do. And the land bank doesn't do it. So what? They're private. They do what they want. It's private money. See how this deal is coming down now? Meanwhile, they've got this farmer to pledge as collateral his land to this land bank. He is now in the contract. Now they got you, farmer. Once you sign that contract, and I saw this happen many times back in the 80s, a farmer would come into Barrister's Inn and he'd say, this farm has been in our family for four generations. And the land bank came to me, or the PCA came to me, and they said, hey, would you like to buy Farmer Jones out over here? He's retiring. And I said, well, yeah, I'd like to buy his land over there, but I don't have the money. And they said, well, we'll loan you the money. And all you have to do is put up the collateral. Put up your farm as collateral, and we'll let you borrow the money from us to buy Farmer Jones out. And he did that. Now, they did this when the price of soybeans was up around $9, $10, $11, $12 a bushel. Then, over time, when they got all these farmers in the Great Plains stretched out on these loans, they collapsed the price of the soybeans. See, this is where Congress comes into the game. Now, the price of soybeans goes down to $5 a bushel, and you can't support the loan. Now, they foreclose on your farm that's been in your family for four generations plus Farmer Jones. Then they turn around and sell that to Archer Daniels Midland or to John Hancock Insurance Company, who has the cash to buy it to create these super corporate farms. That's the way they get to all of you little farmers. They have bankrupted almost all of the little farmers of America. Now, fortunately for all of us, there's a bunch of little farmers out there that haven't succumbed to this yet. I say yet. You know, and just give them time and they'll suck you guys into it too, because if they don't get you, Bob, they're going to get your son. They're educating him in the land, you know, in the farm school over here, in the agricultural school. They're educating him. And they'll educate him to not pay any attention to mom and dad. They're old fogies. You pay attention to us because we know what's going on. We use computers and Blackberries. Well, I want to tell you, boys and girls, I still use 3 to 5 cards, but by God, I ain't brain dead yet. Now, fortunately for me, I didn't sign up for these, but I got to tell you a little story here. One day, I got a brochure in the mail. Now, I'm running a corporation. I'm running a pretty successful business. I'm employing 30 people, and I sell about $100,000 a month in goods. And I'm paying my employees $6 an hour, you know, which is, I think at the time, 3 1/4 was minimum wage. You know, we're paying double minimum wage. All of our jobs are above minimum wage, but some of our jobs are double. And we're doing pretty well. And one day I got a letter from the Small Business Administration, and it was an advertisement that said, we will loan you $500,000. Now, let me tell you, my local bank wouldn't loan me $500,000. They lent me $30,000. I used to run around with a letter of credit in my pocket, you know, for 30 bills, but I didn't have $500,000 worth of credit. In fact, Our entire company was not worth $500,000. When we actually sold it, it was $273,000. That was what our actual capital, equipment, material, and inventory and everything sold for in our going out of business sale. So why would the federal government, through the SBA, want to offer our company $500,000? Okay, well, here's the kicker. For the $500,000 loan, I needed to move my operation from Boise, Idaho to Juarez, Mexico, into the free trade zone within, I think it was 5 miles or 30 miles of the U.S.-Mexican border. I think it was 5 miles. And then I could import tax-free, duty-free, all of my materials that I want from the United States or anywhere else in the world, for that matter. I could buy my lumber and everything else in Mexico. And I would only have to pay my Mexican labor, which down there, top dollar is $2 an hour. Now, I was tempted to do that, but I didn't. And at the time, I said, why in the world would our government want to take my company, which employs 30 Americans here in Boise, Idaho, and move it to Juarez, Mexico, to employ 30 Mexicans? Hey, talk about outsourcing. Talk about offshoring. Hey, that was government policy in 1978. 1978, children. So if you think that this outsourcing and offshoring was something that was thunk up, you know, by Clinton, oh, no, no. I don't even think it was thought up by Carter. This is a program that you see being executed by these secret societies that's been going on now for, oh, hell, 3,000 years, so say the Pharisees. 3,000 years, that's their claim. Well, I just thought I'd pass that story on because it has been executed with flawless success. I didn't buy into it, but that was an accident. And most of you farmers out there have bought into it, and you're dead. You're dead on arrival. Now, you can extricate yourself from it, and if you don't, it's going to come back and destroy you. And for most of you, you probably are destroyed. I'll just be honest with you, you probably are. Some of you might be able to salvage it. It isn't very likely. See, they typically bury you so far in debt that by the time you wake up to reality, that the numbers themselves simply tell you, hey, you can't get there from here. All right, going on, he says, let's see if I can illustrate this. First, I'm going to eliminate all cash transactions from this hypothetical checking account of the Federal Land Bank, except for those that involve this loan. The final figure is precisely the same amount that was in the bank's checking account before it made the loan for the stock. Neither the bank's cash nor the bank's reserves registers any increase or any decrease. And he has a chart over here on page 83 that demonstrates his premise. Now listen. I wouldn't be able to figure this out, and I don't think you would either. This guy's a CPA. He does tax returns. And what happened was, after doing 300 tax returns 1 year after a particular farm bill concerning its depreciation allowance, you see, farmers were depreciating their machinery out over 10 years. Congress came along and said, hey, would you like to depreciate this out over 3 years? And the farmer said, yeah, that's a hell of an idea. You know, I would buy right into that. I would say, God, thank you, that's a hell of an idea. Now, when you depreciate this out over 3 years, taking a look at the tax law and what happens to you when you figure out your tax return, you see, if you're making money, you're all right. But if you're losing money, it bites you in the butt in bankruptcy. And if it hadn't been for this CPA, we wouldn't figure this out. No farmer has ever figured it out. I looked at the numbers. I couldn't figure it out. And he said, no writer, to his knowledge, has ever figured this out. This is the first guy to do this. Now, he figured it out accidentally. It's because he was doing farmers' tax returns, and when he did the farmers' tax returns, these guys are getting buried by the government's tax law. They can't borrow any money for the following year, and they go bankrupt. Because, see, when the farmer goes in to borrow money, he has to be able to show he's got a profitable operation. But because of the tax depreciation allowance, it shows over 3 years that he had a loss, which is fine when you're income averaging. If you're making a profit, it's terrific. But if you're not making a profit and you income average and you take this deduction in 3 years, it shows a loss. You walk into the bank says, I can't loan you money. You're showing a loss. You can't pay the loan back. And the guy says, oh, no, I'm making money, but my tax return shows a loss. No, the banker says, you're showing a loss and we ain't loaning you any money. Now he's bankrupt because the Federal Land Bank says, hey, you're making your payments. Well, I can't make my payments because the commercial bank won't lend me any money so that I can put in a crop. Now, boys and girls, I got to tell you, that's genius. The people that thought this up, that's not an accident. That's been going on for 80 years. It takes a different form with each farm bill. Every time there's a new farm bill, there's some new wrinkle. And every time there's a new wrinkle, the farmer says, oh, thank God, Congress is working for us. No. Wait a minute. Congress isn't working for you. They're working against you. They're working for ADM and Cardiel and Pillsbury. They're working for the land banks and the commercial banks and the Jews and everybody else. The Jewish banker. I shouldn't say Jews, just Jewish bankers. That's the guys they're working for. And it has worked perfectly. Just like we see with this latest transfer of bailout money to the banks. Hey, this thing is working flawlessly. Now, you people are going to get real mad, and you're going to vote in Team A, the Republicans. Excuse me, boys and girls. These people control the Republican and Democratic Party. they play you off of each of these political parties, you know, and they're just eating your lunch. There's a protocol that covers this. Let me see if I can find it here for a second. Here's the one on bribery, production, inoculation. This is the World Coalition. No, that's not the one there. World War III. Here's a good one here. This is the Ninth Protocol. Listen to this. Here's what they're doing. Here's, it works perfectly. In order not to destroy prematurely the Gentile institutions, we've laid our efficient hands upon them, and we have rasped the springs of their mechanism. They were formerly in strict and just order. Yeah, 1900, you farmers were making money. You were doing great. But we have replaced them with a liberal, disorganized, and arbitrary administration. And we have tampered with jurisprudence, the franchise, the press, freedom of the person, and most important of all, education and culture, the cornerstone of free existence. We have misled, stupefied, and demoralized the youth of the Gentiles by means of education in principles and theories that are patently false to us, but which we have inspired, and above existing laws and without actual change, but by distorting them through contradictory interpretations, we have created something stupendous in the way of results. Now, the one I was looking for, the Ninth Protocol, listen to this. People of all opinions and all doctrines are at our service. Restorers of monarchy, demagogues, socialists, communists, and other utopians, we have put them all to work. Every one of them, from his point of view, is undermining the last remnant of authority and is trying to overthrow all existing order. All of the governments have been tormented by these actions, but we will not give them peace until they recognize our super government. When we introduce the poison of liberalism into the governmental organism, its entire political complexion changed. All right, now, what we're witnessing here in this book, he says, let me show you what's happening. And he is. He stumbled across it accidentally because he's a CPA and he's working these farmers' tax returns. And when he worked the farmers' tax return, he got to the bottom line and he says, oh my God, this farmer's bankrupt because of the depreciation allowance. Well, somebody had to think that up in advance. And then they went to Congress and they said, enact this into law. And it has to appear on the surface of it that it is benefiting the farmer. And at first blush, when you look at it, my God, it looks like here's pennies from heaven. And then when you actually put it into practice and you take the depreciation allowance and then you go into your CPA and you give him the numbers and he writes up all the numbers, he comes down on the bottom line and you're losing money, which is exactly what the tax return is supposed to show, so that you don't have to pay any tax. But in order to borrow money on your farming operation, you have to be showing a profit. How's that for genius?